Welcome to this very special Season 5 presentation of Airtime, presented by AIR in partnership with the Eisman Center for Performing Arts and Alamo Drafthouse. Airtime is a signature guest artist interview series featuring artists and creative thinkers in Richardson and the greater North Texas area, where artists share about their art and why their creativity makes a difference. It's February the 5th, 2015, and today's guest artists for this very special airtime include Kate Geis, Director of Creative Domain, and Robert Aberlin, Executive Producer, Paul Taylor Dance Company Rehearsal Director Andy LeBeau, and company dancers James Sampson and Plano native Parisa Kolbda. Please give a warm welcome to our panelists and to our moderator, Chris Tucker.
Thank you and welcome to Airtime here at the Alamo Drafthouse in Richardson, Texas. Alamo Drafthouse is located on the southwest corner of Beltline Road and Highway 75. My name is Chris Tucker and I'm your moderator. In my years as a radio announcer for WRR, composer, performer, and conductor, organizations such as Arts Incubator of Richardson engage its community with worthwhile events to showcase the arts. Airtime is a program designed to be a collective think tank on the arts, and we accomplish this by bringing in the artists from our community and engaging our audience members. In radio broadcasting, time is an important component, and here at Airtime, we keep an eye on the clock. When the time is up for a particular section, we'll hear this sound, a desk bell. Please welcome to the Alamo Drafthouse stage five incredible guests. Kate Geis, producer-director of the documentary Creative Domain, Robert Aberlin, executive producer, Paul Taylor, dance company, rehearsal director, or actually assistant to the artistic director, Annie LeBeau, and company dancers James Sanson and Parisa Kolbda. Please give another round of applause. Well, thank you all for coming by. In the usual airtime flow, we would start with the interview and then proceed on to the viewing of the film. Now, this works as the film is loosely connected with the guest or guests, but in this case, a wonderful opportunity presented itself because of our guests today. And thanks to the Eisman Center for the Performing Arts and their managing director, Bruce McPherson, along with the Paul Taylor Dance Company. We viewed the film first, documentary titled Creative Domain, about the creative process of one of Paul Taylor's exquisite choreographed masterpieces, this one titled Three Dubious Memories. Let's turn to the producer-director of the documentary, Kate Geis. What was the driving force behind wanting to produce a documentary about Paul Taylor? Your bio shows a personal connection with the ballet from your youth.
Mm-hmm. I think if you guys can hear me all right. Yeah. Actually, it's probably a good time to give a shout out to my dad, who's sitting in the first row. And my dad introduced me. My dad, Bob Geis, was a USIA officer, public affairs officer, and he hosted Paul Taylor Dance Company in the Soviet Union in the late 1970s. And so when I was about 9 years old, my dad started telling me about how important Taylor was as an artist and to the world, and so I have to credit him for me knowing about him at all. So many years later, was working at Channel 13 in New York, and my boss introduced me to Robert Aberlin, who has been on the board of Taylor for 22 years. And I've always, you know, this was sort of a, when I knew that, when you told me that you were on the board, I was sort of thinking, oh, someday, maybe, there'll be an opportunity. But this project, how it came about, I think, is probably best told by Robert, because that's a feat in itself. Because Dance Maker had been made in 1998 and is really the film that tells the story of Paul and the company and how this all came to be. But the piece that we really wanted to focus on and dive into was the creative process and how Paul creates a work and just focus completely on that. So, and that is something that Paul was kind of reluctant to show.
Well, tell us, when you had decided to make this documentary and start the project, did you speak with Paul Taylor about what kind of project he's working on at that point, or did Three Dubious Memories just happen to be there for this documentary, or did you think, okay, this is the projects he's going to work on over the next 3 years, I want to try to capture this one?
You don't know, really. And this is, I think you should tell the story at this point.
So about 2 years before we made this film, I convinced Paul to do a very short film about the Taylor II Company. And Taylor II does a lot of outreach, goes to schools and hospitals, and they're up in the back there. Say hello to them. And we tried to raise money for Taylor II. And I said to John Tomlinson, who's also here, who's the executive director, and Paul, people don't understand what outreach is. So Kate and I followed them for 3 days in Syracuse, New York, and we did about a 12-minute film. And instead of raising about $70,000 or $80,000, it raised about $180,000. So suddenly we had some credibility with Paul. And he knows how difficult it is to raise money for the arts. And so I sort of did a white lie and said I just wanted to do another 15-minute piece about his creative process. And he said, oh, who cares? Nobody will be interested in that. And so we spent some time, John and I, convincing him that people would care. But again, it was just going to be very short. We had no idea what he was going to do. No idea what he was going to do. And we just had some camera people ready, and we went in, and it was, you know, just luck. And it was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating, as you can see. 2 weeks before we started, John and I and Paul were having a Budweiser, which is what Paul likes. He's very thrifty. He said, I don't want to do it. Not going to do it. And I said, what? I have a camera crew coming, and we paid them already, and the sound people are coming. And John spent some time talking to him, and I spent some time talking to him. And we convinced him that we would just come in to see the very beginning, where he gives the instructions to the dancers. So just let us get that, because, you know, we can't replicate that. And we got in there, and we never left. And it didn't turn out to be 15 minutes, as you can see. So once we got there, he got comfortable, and he just forgot we were there.
So, Kate, now that the project is well underway, what was your approach? What was your initial ideas to capture his creative process in film?
To stay out of the way as much as possible, honestly. We really, and Robert and I were kind of hiding in a back room off to the side, and it was Tom Hurwitz and our sound person Tom Hurwitz is the cameraman, and Peter Miller was our sound person, and they were the ones in the room sort of basically trying to stay, you know, within the appropriate range of getting the shot and getting the sound, giving the moments where Paul's asking the dancer to kind of take a pose or do all the, getting those moments, but at the same time, you know, just being conscious of not getting too close. And so if we were kind of in the mix, we would be distracting to him, mm-hmm. and then he might remember he was making a documentary. So we just needed to kind of be as much as we could be flies on the wall in the space. The process is just sort of watching and seeing what happened every day and watching each layer of the dance as it was being made. What we'd also do is, because we couldn't get super close, we would go back into the studio and have the dancers put on their sometimes sweaty and dirty clothes from the day before and record the dance a little bit closer each time, so that there are some scenes where you're kind of intercutting Paul, you know, giving instruction and being there, and then you're also seeing the dance without him there, so that we could actually be very close to the dancers.
As you mentioned,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Tom Hurwitz, the camera person, is really critical in this. He was the cameraman for Dance Banker, and his mother was a Martha Graham dancer,
Jim and
he grew up with dance. He would wear dancing slippers on the floor with his camera and run around while he filmed. And that was another comfort level for Paul. He knew Tom, he knew his mother, and that helped a lot.
To Andy now, the assistant to the artistic director. We were mentioning about wanting to, or your desire, Kate, to have Paul, or stay away from Paul Taylor as much as possible. But there's still some, I would say, think, a artistic connection between you and the artistic element of Paul Taylor Dance Company. Was that with Andy? I mean, did you guys have a lot of conversations during this process, during the filmmaking? Andy, I saw you in the back of much of the film with a pencil, with a pad. What are you doing during this process?
You know, wow, it was a long time ago, and I honestly say, I mean, I just have a few memories of it. I mean, Kate and Robert and I would typically meet early in the morning and just kind of discuss what was going to happen during the day and what was important to them as far as the development of where we were going, as well as me sharing what Paul's plan for the day was, which of course could not be interrupted in any way, shape, or form. So we would kind of figure out the best way together how to attack the day so that they were still getting the artistic part of it, but without it interfering with Paul's work. I was kind of a translator in a way, you know, just making sure the logistics of everything worked out during the process, and everyone hopefully was happy.
Well, this question was actually for Kate, but I think this applies to about everybody. Creative Domain, as you guys have seen and know, is about the creative process of Paul Taylor. From a filmmaker perspective, or a dancer perspective, or an artistic director perspective, when producing Creative Domain, did you guys have a part of the creative process that you admired more than others? And I guess for Kate, the specific question is it about the feelings of the accomplishment of seeing the completed film, or the memories and experiences of the filmmaking process?
Paul was interviewed recently, and I'm going to respond kind of similar to what he says, because I agree with it in that he loves making the work. Mm-hmm. He loves being in the studio. I love being in the studio and watching the process, kind of observing it. But for me, the part where I get to be closest to the artist sometimes is when I'm editing them, when I get to study their face, when I get to listen to the rhythm of how they're speaking about a topic, to be able to, the way that Paul reads a dancer in terms of when he's choosing a dancer for the company or trying to study a person, there's a lot of similarities between that kind of focus in the editing process, because you're just looking for things that are unsaid. Mm-hmm. The you know, the way his eyes move, that long lingering laugh he might have, or smirk that, you know, like we all kind of get. We know there's something going on, there's another layer to what's going on, but he's not saying it. So editing and making films is also nonverbal, so there's a lot of pieces to that that I feel like are fit very appropriately with choreography.
You learn in the documentary about the colors of dance, how he approaches with colors. Is there such a thing in the filmmaking world, the colors of film, something in the post-production as you're looking at all this footage and deciding what to use, can colors of film be a good correlation to your work?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think in terms of storytelling, it was important to show that Jennifer Tipton wanted to have those moments of seeing that with each memory of the different points of view of the characters, that you could see that there was a large red light or a large blue light or green light, so that you knew whose memory you're watching. So color was very important from that standpoint. I do look at, I think about Paul as having been a painter also, in some ways, and when he's choreographing, it's sort of something in the back of the mind, and the references that people make throughout the film, the way Betty talks about Paul's colors, and Andy refers to the colors, how people get selected for certain roles in the dance. I think those, to me, are kind of more part of the storytelling part of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's aspects to the dance itself that are like paintings to me also, like the Greek chorus, you could say, is like a Greek, you know, like a relief. And the 3D in front of it could be like a pop art Liechtenstein in front of it, you know? It's like those two things going on at the same time. So those are painterly in a way.
Let's stay with the colors of dance and then go to our dancers here today. Would you like to expand on that? From a dancer perspective, the idea of Paul Taylor's approach through color.
As far as the color, what I think Betty was talking about was just kind of like having each dancer being expressed in a different way through Paul's eyes. Paul sees you when he hires you into the company in a certain way and may give you, you know, a lot of funny roles or a lot of very serious stoic roles, but then perhaps puts this other color on you and puts you in something that is maybe kind of less desirable for you, or something that really challenges you in a way that he thinks you need, you know, to be challenged. And it plays with all the dancers. I mean, every single one of us is challenged. And I think we get into the company and he puts dancers into certain roles. We're like, yeah, they look good in that role. And that's how Paul sees her. We know it. And then he'll, you know, another dance will come around and he'll just kind of change up the casting and put someone into a different role. And it's just amazing. I mean, it's the part that we love about it, where we get to express ourselves in every way possible. I mean, with the range of Paul's work, there's so many colors that you can play. And there's so many roles that I love personally. And just doing a piece in rehearsal yesterday called Last Look, where it's very earthy and gritty and mean and sexual, and you just, it's one of the dances that I put my heart most into at times, because it just demands that. And then you just have these other pieces where you're running across stage making people laugh. That's how I see the colors in my mind that Paul talks about.
From the dancers, what was it like to be a part of the filming of this documentary? Is there a different approach involved? Or you know, you're seeing obviously more cameras in your face as you're rehearsing. But I mean, as Kate had said, you know, their approach was to kind of stay away as much as possible. But from a dancer's perspective, what was it like being in the filming of this documentary?
Yeah, it's very special. It really is. And I've seen this probably like 4 or 5 times already in showings. And it's really fantastic. And I love looking back on the experience and how, you know, I worked with Paul, and then I remember how, you know, great it was, and it was rather easy, and we had a great rapport, and we just kind of like flowed with each other nicely, and, you know, we understood each other's ideas, and I got what he meant. And yeah, it's a wonderful thing to be, you know, a part of that document, because it is a document, and it'll be around forever, and it's a wonderful chance to really, you know, kind of have it written in the history books and go back and just kind of see yourself. I mean, that's surely what I think. Go ahead, please. Oh, well, yeah.
That's right. I played the role of the injured dancer.
Yeah. I quickly forgot.
Could I just say, when you see the performance there, the Eisenman Center was wonderful, but we couldn't have that many cameras and that many angles there. So we shot it again at SUNY Purchase's stage. And I remember James did that handstand 5 times we shot that. And after the 4th one, he said, I don't think I can do this again, you know? So it was different for them. And they were wonderful to let us do that. But we had people on ladders and on, you know, moving across the stage and all kinds of things. So.
To me, that's actually what makes dance so different than a painting. It's ephemeral. And without the stage, without the dancers, as Paul says in the documentary, he talks about he needs these bodies and he needs the space and the time to create. He has all of his notes, he has all these rules, but when he comes in and what this film captures is almost, it's the dancer's perspective of that, that energetic exchange with him as he's creating something from nothing. I think this film actually captures that, that sacredness of that experience with him.
And speaking of Paul Taylor, the film expressed that he's a private person. He is reserved at times. I guess a general question to everybody, maybe Andy can spend a little more time on this, is how close can you really get to Paul Taylor?
Well, I mean, there's two different kinds of close. You know, there's that that working rapport and that closeness, which I think is the side that you can only get to know with Paul from working with him for a very long time. And you can, you know, I think you, the film captures a lot of that, how that one-on-one with Paul, and you, and I think Amy Young said it really well. There's not, there's a lot of unverbal communication. And that's something that's really slowly created over time. It doesn't just happen quickly. And that's the part of just being around and being dedicated and really listening to what he says. And he always says how he watches people to understand. And I think in a work environment, that's the best way to get to know Paul, is to watch him and almost analyze him the way he says he analyzes people. And then, of course, there's the personal level. And getting to know Paul on a personal level is very easy on a one-on-one. I think it gets more difficult in groups because, it's far be it for me to say, but I feel like Paul is more comfortable in a small group setting, you know, one-on-one, one-on-two. I think when it becomes a large group, I think it's overwhelming for him because everyone admires him. Everybody wants to talk to him. Everybody wants a piece of his ear. So I think it becomes much more difficult to get to know him on a personal level.
To Kate or Robert, in the process of this documentary, I guess away when the cameras were off, did you find yourself having a one-on-one time with Paul Taylor, or when the cameras were off, you had to leave and he went home? And tell us about your relationship with Paul during this process.
I think for making this film, it was much more kind of just disappearing. He was, you know, creating. He's in the studio. He had his work to do, and then he really needed to leave after his work was done. So, you know, I think for me, the relationship really was in front of this television monitor, studying him, honestly, and then presenting him the film when it was finished, and spending 2 hours in his apartment watching him watch the film and listening to him watch the film, and reacting to things that I was hoping he would react to that would feel real for him or authentic to him. So when we finished, I asked him if it felt authentic, and he said that it was. It definitely felt authentic for him. So we got this approval from him that came later, and that was sort of what I was waiting for. But it just took, you know, a year and plus to actually have that time to actually feel like it was validated by him.
I would say we had a little bit of approval in the following: when we went in to interview him in his apartment, most people said, and I know this, he hates doing interviews like this. You might get 20 minutes from him, and we were there for an hour and a half. So somehow, I think he did feel like it was becoming a conversation. I think that's because I've known him a long time. I think that's because the cameraman he's known for a long time. So we that comfort zone, sort of in the back, I hope, was reached, and we were able to talk to him much more than he usually is willing to do.
Our president of AIR, Kitty Goddard, sent me a link a couple days ago in my preparation for this interview. It was of another interview, and just in speaking of what your story just told, I guess there was one stipulation he actually did an interview, and it was aired during a segment of an interview with you, and the stipulation was it had to be at 4:30 in the morning. And that just struck me. I was like, oh my goodness, I don't think I could ever wake up that early. So I don't know if that was him finishing up his work or starting the work that morning. But quite interesting to hear about that. To the dancers, in working with Paul Taylor, does the dancer-performer also become an interpreter? Or does the dancer only move to what the choreographer gives? I mean, is there some give and take? Is there moments where you might say, well, how about if I do this versus this? Or is it, you know, this? He says this, do this.
Yeah, we are definitely interpreters. A lot of give and take. If there was no give, there would be nothing at times. It's kind of changed over the years, but he, in creative processes, will have a certain idea, but only go so far. So then he would love for the dancer to kind of like collaborate and give ideas on their behalf as well. So he'll just kind of do something and be like, well, now what's gonna happen? And so then I just start to move and, you know, do stuff and just kind of move around and see what he likes. Because if I didn't do anything, you know, he would probably kick me out of the piece, maybe, I don't know. But there'll be times where it's a huge group section as well. And he just wants everyone to move across the floor, and whatever he sees fit for that piece and for that phrase, he'll kind of grab and he'll take from someone, oh yeah, I like that. That was good. And he will then rework it again and kind of codify it in a way, or tailorize it even more, perhaps, or make it nice or pretty or dark, for what he likes for that instance. So a huge play with, choreographer and dancer. It's really, it's fantastic.
Well, I have to throw out one specific question to our native daughter, Parisa. Yeah. Born and raised in Plano, earned a degree from SMU in Dallas. And now your journey is with the Paul Taylor Dance Company, which you debuted with the company in 2003. Is this how you pictured your life taking shape, from Plano to New York?
Absolutely not. No, I had no idea. I thought I knew what I wanted. Actually, there's a woman, just an absolute angel, Kathy Chamberlain. She was the one that encouraged me to dance in college, and sight unseen, I joined the dance department there, and I started seeing the works of Paul Taylor, and it changed my life. So you don't know what you don't know, and you can only plan so much, and life just has a way of taking you places.
Kate, what can you say about the dancers in the documentary? Did they make good interview subjects, or did you have to twist any arms to get them to speak?
Fortunately, with all of the Taylor dancers, everyone's very, very articulate. And that's something that Tom Hurwitz also remarked on. It's just that Taylor dancers really, you guys are very intellectual about, you know, just in life and also in how you dance. So that makes for, you know, you have to have that for making a documentary. Otherwise, there is a piece of this, which is often a huge part of making a documentary, that is very verbal. And so you're layering the nonverbal gestures and the choreography and the storytelling of that over people's impressions. And trying to piece together also your own sense of what you think is happening. So sometimes it's a process of drawing that out of you guys and asking you questions and seeing if, you know, if there's a similar, if, you know, if what we think we're seeing is actually what you're feeling. And it's one of the reasons why we kind of prodded Paris a little bit more on that understanding of just wanting more from Paul as well, which I was so grateful for when you answered so honestly, because I felt like everybody wants that, those more moments with Paul, you know. So you really shared yourself so much.
Yeah, I think in the making of this movie, you're asking us to use words to describe, I mean, words almost seem like the enemy to describe dance, and it's a language that we all speak.
It's internal.
It's energy, yeah. It's primitive. It's like, I mean, I admire critics that can write well about dance for that reason.
So the Paul Taylor Dance Company performs this Saturday, February 7th, 2015, 8 p.m. at the Eisenman Center for the Performing Arts in Richardson. For more information, you can visit eisenmancenter.com. What can we expect this Saturday? Any teasers, anything exciting you want to mention that we're going to get excited about now for it? The whole thing, I guess.
Animals.
Yeah, a few dogs on stage.
Before my final question, are there any websites that we can go to for more information about Paul Taylor or the documentary itself?
Yep. Paul Taylor, creativedomain.com is the website film. We also want you to go to our Facebook page and please like us. That would be wonderful. But and then Paul Taylor Dance Company's website, of course.
I think that's ptdc.org.
Exactly.
Is the actual website.
And
actually, I'll just add, it's also ptamd.org, Paul Taylor's American Modern. I don't know if anybody's heard, but Paul Taylor has gone on a new initiative to include American masters within his New York City Lincoln Center season. So instead of trying to explain it all here, I encourage you to go to the website and read about the new change that Paul is trying to make in modern dance today.
All right, so at this time, we'll turn to the audience for some questions. So please, if you have anything you want to ask, just raise your hand.
First, I'd like to say that was excellent to see the process of your dance. My question is, what's next? Do any of you plan on becoming a choreographer?
I would say no. but having said that, I've already choreographed a piece. Actually, for a friend who teaches at a university in Arlington, Texas. Yeah. For community college there, I went there this summer, and she has these fantastic students, and she's really rising up in the ranks there at the school as one of the great teachers, and asked me to come set a piece. We went to college together for a year, but we danced a little bit together. I'm from Jefferson City, Missouri. We grew up a little bit there and then went to school together. So just from way back when, you know, we've been friends. And so I did something for her and repeated that same choreography for another friend in Omaha, Nebraska, this last November. So that's all I've done. I don't really, you know, but to be someone like Paul or a huge choreographer, no, not really. Just dabble here and there.
Paul really satisfies my need to create.
Ditto.
That said, choreographing is a muscle that needs exercising, and right now 100% of my life is committed to creating with Paul. So that said, in reference to a couple questions ago, I don't know what I don't know.
We all witnessed in the documentary your inspiration within the rehearsal space. But what inspires you outside of the rehearsal space? Because we all know that you can't live by one art alone. So whether it's from producing the film or the dance or support roles, what inspires you outside of that?
James and I, we see a lot of dance together. We just saw NDT 2.
Netherlands Dance Theater 2.
Doug Elkins.
Yeah, we see some Broadway shows when we can. Yeah, it's great to see all that stuff. It's great to have someone to see with. But I mean, being a dancer, I love seeing other dance too. I mean, I'm inspired by young kids, like, you know, Paul Taylor, you know, the Second Company, they teach kids all day long. And, you know, even though they're young and they're still coming into their own, and I, you know, if I were in their shoes, I would be inspired by these little kids. Like, I go watch, you know, and they could be the worst things in the world. But, and then you see, like, students that do Paul Taylor's work in universities that are still, like, kind of new into the Paul Taylor experience. I love seeing them take on, you know, his work and how they interpret it. That's, like, that's really inspiring to me. And, you know, in another life, I would be a prima ballerina in New York City Ballet or something, but I love watching those guys.
As I've gotten older, I realize I've become quieter. And I think when I was 22 and I joined this company, I was seeing as much as possible. I was seeing everything. And I was doing everything. And now I find that I enjoy doing nothing. And really just and watching and observing. I think part of what actually makes Paul an incredible creator is that he's a man of solitude. He likes to be alone. And I think it's I think he's able to go really deep into what humanity is and make the work that he has because he doesn't want to socialize and constantly be busy, constantly doing. He's just being.
So this film is about an hour and a half long. The learning of three dubious memories, how long did that take in its entirety? Are we talking about a three-month process, a six-month process to come to this fruition of what we saw in the final production?
Well, Paul allows himself 6 weeks during a creative period. And I think, that's padding it a little bit. I think he says in the movie that he really tries to time it out in a four-week period, working 4 days a week, an hour and a half the day. Because meanwhile, the rehearsal, once Paul is finished working, each day he'll work like an hour and a half. And then afterward, the dancers are busy reviving and rehearsing many of the other pieces that will be in the touring rep. So the day is not wasted by any way, shape, or form. I would say about, I guess if you do that 6 hours a week, about 24 hours altogether, and Mr. Taylor can put out a piece. And of course, you know, he constantly tinkers with it, constantly makes changes. Even though you saw the scene in the film that they captured with him, Santo Loquasto, and him talking and saying, I really think it's coming together. And, you know, and Paul said, well, I think I'm just going to leave it as it is, you know. He said that, but I can guarantee you there were more changes. I think there was a change where he did finally cut out that hug at the end between Rob and James. I don't know if you remember, but in the film that was a big discussion with the dancers as well. Right, Rob does go up to James and hug him, but James doesn't do any movement anymore. He just stands there like a stone. So, he'll constantly tinker with it. But all in all, it's about an hour and a half to an hour, 4 days for 4 weeks.
But if I could just add to that, is this working?
Yeah.
As he says in the film, he spends months listening to the music, yes, and that book of his. I mean, I think many of us have known him for a long time, had no idea. I mean, that was a revelation for me, to see that book, to see how much work went into it, for him to share his mistakes, his crossouts, his diagrams. He spends a tremendous amount of time preparing to spend that 4 to 6 weeks in the studio. So it's probably like a three-month process when you get through it all.
I was curious if you could talk a little bit about how Paul's process has changed as a choreographer as he's gotten older. You know, when you're younger, you can show more sort of give the dancers a clearer idea physically what you're asking of them, and how he's changed as he can't show as much, and how he's able to go about that process of getting the dancers to where he wants them to be as he creates.
Well, I started with a company back in 1993, and Paul would very much get up and literally do every step. He would jump and, you know, do lifts with the women and everything. And I think back then he could come in with a lot of the movement vocabulary already prepared, stuff that he had been able to physicalize that you could tell he had, like, made a concrete decision that he liked that. So not to say that there still wasn't a lot of give and take with the dancers, because I think that comes over, you know, the development of a piece. But and I think over time he's really begun to embrace the fact that he just can't get up and do that anymore. So it seems to me that he focuses a lot more on vocabulary, or I should say kind of a middle part of this development. He started really working with dancers who he'd been working with for many years, who he knew really understood him and what he might be asking for. And he would work with them on, say, a solo or a duet to really start to let that vocabulary kind of materialize. And then that was enough to fire him up to create an entire, you know, group section or a chorus or something like that. And I think now it's even gone into another new level where Paul will actually tell the dancers the day before, like, you know, here's the music, this is the idea, this is the kind of movement I'm looking for. And he doesn't expect it, but he enjoys it very much if they come in the next day with a few movement ideas. And the amazing thing to see is how they'll do something and he'll completely change it. I mean, from top to bottom. But, you know, you gotta have a place to start. So, I mean, that's just kind of a quick development that I've witnessed over the years.
Hey, Kate, one final question. It just popped in my head. How many times have this documentary been shown, and what have you gotten feedback from the reception of this film that you guys created? It's so great.
Thank you for saying that. Let's see here. It feels like 20 times now, maybe a little less. We premiered in New York at Lincoln Center, the Film Society at Dance on Camera. It was a closing night performance film. And that was because it was, you know, the opening for the film. It was definitely among friends. It was in New York. There's a lot of love in the room. We had James was there, Amy Young was there. We had Sean was there. Yep, to talk about the experience of you know, working with Paul and then Bill making the dance. With each audience. We always want to have, especially for this experience afterwards, a lot of different voices to share with you what everyone's experience is of working with Paul. And so with each screening, I feel like there's another color that comes out again, actually, to borrow what you were talking about earlier. Just recently, we just played the film at the Art Carl Museum of Picture Book Art in Amherst, Massachusetts, and that's actually right next to where I live now. And that was a extraordinary evening also of just people that were crazy about Paul, and I didn't know that they lived all around me. It was just this fabulous evening of just finding people who really get his movement, really get him, and get his humor. And that's the thing, I really love listening to people laugh during the film, because he's funny. He's really funny.
All righty, so this is how we close out Airtime. We do it with a game, a one-minute game we call the Top 10 Shorties. Well, we have five people on the panel, so I've dedicated two questions each to each of them, so I guess just pass the mics around as I call out your name. So here we go in 3, 2, 1. To Kate, as a producer, are you a night owl or morning person?
Morning person.
To Robert, Elvis or the Beatles?
The Beatles.
Andy, when jotting down Paul Taylor's notes, do you use black, blue pens, or pencils?
Pencil.
To Parisa, your favorite DFW restaurant?
Seasons 52.
Okay. To James, a person that you draw creative inspiration from in your daily life?
Andy LeBeau.
To Kate, are you a cat or dog person?
Cat.
To Robert, this actually came from your bio. Would you rather count dollar bills or dance steps? You said you were a banker, so I thought, well, that might work.
I'd rather count dance steps.
To Parisa, would you rather dance high energy or slow and intimate?
Both.
I'm giving you all the hard questions, aren't I? To James, your favorite music artist to listen to?
Oh, good one. Katy Perry.
Okay. To Andy, if you had $1 million, what would be the first item you would purchase?
I'd become a board member with the Paul Taylor Dance Company.
Brown nose.
And that's our 10 questions, but I have an 11th for everybody. A final question to all. Paul Taylor, as we've talked about, uses a color vocabulary at times. If you were a color, what would you be?
I was a banker, green.
Come on.
I would say purple.
Try going to a restaurant with him.
Like both ways. Yeah. Kind of in the middle. Yeah.
Yellow.
Red.
And then Kate?
Gray.
Okay. A round of applause for Kate Geis, Robert Aberlin, Andy LeBeau, James Sampson, Parisa Kobda. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Airtime, created by Arntz Incubator of Richardson, and I'm your moderator, Chris Tucker, here at Alamo Draft House in Richardson, Texas. Airtime is funded in part by the City of Richardson Cultural Arts Commission. We invite you to check out artsincubatorrichardson.org for future events and news. And here's our president, Kitty Goddard.
Just a few more words, although it's going to be hard to beat the words that have already been on the screen and been shared here tonight with our illustrious panel. You all were just awesome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I wanted to reiterate a comment that Robert made. It's difficult to raise funds for the arts. And, you know, we all feel that. But I will have to say that this evening being a fundraiser for AIR was because of the generosity and the compassion and the enabling of the Paul Taylor Dance Company, the Eisman Center for Performing Arts, and Alamo Draft House. So we appreciate each one of you who purchased a ticket this evening to help support AIR, Arts Incubator of Richardson, its programming, and its building campaign. So thank you. A round of applause for all of you. I also wanted to take a moment to pay special recognition to some of our city council members who are here this evening. Councilman Steve Mitchell, Bob Townsend, Paul Volker, and Mr. Scott Dunn. And we appreciate your taking the time to be here this evening to not only support AIR and the Eisman Center, but the creative atmosphere that is in Richardson. You love dance. Apparently you do because you're here. At each of your spaces, there is a flyer that tells you how to contact the Eisman to get tickets for this Saturday's performances. And you've heard about them. You can read the flyer, take it with you, get tickets. If you've never seen the Paul Taylor Dance Company, you must be there Saturday, especially now with all the insight that we have. So please be there. I know I will be. Special thanks to Bruce McPherson, Sarah Nesbitt, and Amy Taylor of the Eisman Center for all of their support in this partnership. Again, a huge round of applause for the Paul Taylor Dance Company and the Eisman Center for their partnership this evening. Thank you, and have a great evening.